Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In March 2015, U.S. astronaut Captain Scott Kelly blasted off from Kazakhstan for the International Space Station. He would go on to spend 340 days there on the longest space mission by an American astronaut ever. It wasn't all fun and games. Space can be deadly, boring, and taxing on the body. His was being compared to his identical twins, astronaut Mark Kelly, back on Earth. Now Scott Kelly is more or less telling all about his near year in space and thinking about the path to Mars. This hour on Point, we're talking about a year in space with Scott Kelly. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Can you picture it? Nearly a year up there. What's your question for Scott Kelly? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And today, you'll find a live stream of this interview on Facebook, so be sure to check that out. Go all the way back to 2015. Then President Barack Obama had invited astronaut Scott Kelly to his 2015 State of the Union address. And here it was a little bit from that, just 2 months before Kelly left for his near year aboard the International Space Station.
Last month, we launched a new spacecraft as part of a re-energized space program that will send American astronauts to Mars. And in 2 months, to prepare us for those missions, Scott Kelly will begin a year-long stay in space. So good luck, Captain. Make sure to Instagram it. We're proud of it.
And Instagram it he did on March 27th. A lot of us followed that. March 27th, 2015. Scott Kelly and two Russian cosmonauts departed for the International Space Station as that part of that year, his year-long mission, conducting research on the long-term effects of space travel on the human body. Here was that takeoff.
Engines and flaps on thrust.
And liftoff. A year in space starts now. Kelly, Kornienko, and Padalka on their way towards the International Space Station.
Scott Kelly, Mikhail Kornienko, and Gennady Padalka, they'd get to know each other quite well up there. We'll hear about it. Not all fun and games, no. From an earlier trip up, this is a clip from 2010, Scott Kelly demonstrating how astronauts eat on board the space station in zero gravity with food packaged in little envelopes.
Basically, we just eat all this stuff right out of the packaging. So I'm going to cut open my beef stew, and as you can see, some of it's trying to escape on me already. And this isn't the asparagus I made, because the asparagus floated away somewhere. Not sure where it went. I'm sure it'll turn up in a couple of days.
The asparagus floated away somewhere. We're going to get into all the details in this hour. Joining me now in the studio is retired astronaut Scott Kelly. In October 2015, he set the American record for the total consecutive number of days spent in space, from 2015 to 2016, 340 days. He's a former military fighter pilot, veteran of four space flights. His new books out just yesterday are Endurance, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Discovery, and a children's book, My Journey to the Stars. You can link to an excerpt of Endurance at our website, onpointradio.org. Scott Kelly with me in the studio. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Take us back to that takeoff. You were in Kazakhstan. I mean, this is after the space shuttle program was shut down. So then, as now, we were reliant on Russians to go up. How did you get over there? What did it look like when you got to Kazakhstan? What was it like to get into a Soviet launch vehicle, a Russian? You had done plenty of American launches, but this was new.
Yeah, correct. So I left Houston about 6 weeks before our launch, which is in Kazakhstan, like you said. I actually flew to Moscow. Mm-hmm. We have a place called Star City. It's where we train, the Gagarin Cosmonaut Training Center. It's in the Moscow suburbs.
Train with Russians to sort of learn their way so that you can work together on the takeoff and time?
Yeah. You know, part of the space station is Russian. Parts of it are the U.S. Segment, and there are other European components to it. But since half of the space station is Russian built, and the vehicle we launch on is the Soyuz. We do a lot of training in Star City. Mm-hmm. So I flew over there about 6 weeks prior, did final exams and some other refresher training, some ceremonial stuff. Mm-hmm. And then about a week prior, you fly down to Baikonur, which is in Kazakhstan, Central Asia.
What's the terrain like around there? We all think of Cape Canaveral, but this isn't on the sea.
This is the high desert, so brutally hot in the summer and brutally cold in the winter. And it's a, you know, former Soviet, formerly part of the Soviet Union. And like a lot of those former Soviet satellite states, the, you know, the infrastructure looks a little bit old and left over, a little bit archaic and at times. But that's where we now launch from. And because we don't, like you said, we don't have the space shuttle to launch from Florida.
Every American who goes up from there.
Right now, yes, that is our single point access to space is through Baikonur. And now, of course, the Chinese have a capability too, but we don't participate in that.
What was the launch like compared to an American launch? I'm looking here at a photograph of that Soyuz, those huge rockets. It's just got a different look to it from the American rockets that took astronauts up. What was the process like? What was the equipment like once you were in there?
So the you know, the Soyuz, and the word Soyuz means union in in Russian, like you know, a union of people, or you know,
like a Soviet Union, perhaps.
That's exactly correct. And the word Soyuz applies to both the rocket and the capsule.
Okay.
They really like that word, apparently, so they used it twice.
Mm-hmm.
And the Soyuz is similar to the space shuttle in that it launches people into space, and then that's kind of where the similarity stops. Much smaller, single, just a single purpose really is just to get three people into space cheaply, reliably, and it does that very well.
This is the space capsule part, so it's not like the shuttle that would come back and land on a runway somewhere. It comes down the old-fashioned way.
True. The only piece that eventually makes it home is the capsule that is a part of actually three components that fly all the way to the space station. The rest of the rocket crashes in, into the desert. But, you know, it's not like the space shuttle. The space shuttle had the solid rocket motors, much more power, much more flexibility, much more capability, much more complicated. So not always a consistent launching on time. You know, often space shuttle flights were delayed.
We remember very well.
Yeah, the Soyuz has not delayed a launch since the crew, once the crew has gotten in since the 1960s.
So simpler, but very reliable.
Simpler, reliable, but still very serious business. I mean, when you go from zero to 17,500 miles an hour in 9 minutes, that's a lot of energy. And and in the case of the Soyuz, you're lying on your back. It's about as small as it can possibly be, and you could fit three, you know, grown people in there. Your knees are up to your chin. It's not a particularly comfortable experience.
What does it feel like? I don't know how many G's that is. Just what, for those of us who've never come close to it, what's it feel like?
Well, the G's, unlike in an airplane, the G's in a spacecraft are all due to the rocket motors firing and the acceleration behind you. So it's pushing on your back. So the acceleration is through your chest. A lot of people think of, you know, acceleration in an airplane. Maybe you could pass out because the blood is being pushed out of your head. That's not the case in both the space shuttle and the Soyuz. But gets up to, for launch, about 4 G's of acceleration.
Is it hard to breathe if it's on your chest?
Yes, it can be. Absolutely. And it was actually harder to breathe in the space shuttle. I think it was because of the design of the seat and the straps on your chest and the oxygen bottles would actually kind of compress your chest to make it difficult to breathe as you got were accelerating quicker and quicker. And the acceleration increases as you burn fuel and the spacecraft gets lighter.
So it gets faster and faster, so you've got more pressure as it goes.
More acceleration, the lighter the vehicle gets.
Was it different for you because you'd been up several times already? Was it different knowing that you were going up for such a long time? You 340 days. Yeah. What was the longest you'd been up before this flight?
159.
So this is double plus.
Yes, absolutely. And it was funny, and I mentioned this in the book, that as soon as we got on orbit and we raised our visors and we were probably in space for, I don't know, about 20 minutes, I turned to my colleague, Misha, and I said something to the effect that our lives without noise has ceased to exist for the next year, because I realized, you know, the fan noise in there And the Soyuz is very similar to the noise in the space station.
Oh, so it's not the stillness of space when you're on these missions.
Yeah, when you're inside the spacecraft, there's always, you know, some fan or
humming,
some
buzzing
motor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, pushing stuff around.
So there you were. You're heading out. It's 340 days. I mean, you had colleagues on here, and we should be candid in talking about how Russians have spent much more time than this in space, right? I mean, Gennady's been up in his lifetime something like 850 days.
Yeah, Podolka has the most days in space of any human. I don't know what his single longest flight was. It's probably around, you know, 6 or 7 months. But both the Soviet Union and Russia have had cosmonauts that have spent longer than 340 days in space. I think my flight was probably on the order of maybe the fifth longest of anyone, but the longest on the space station and the longest for an American.
Was it exciting to be headed up for that amount of time, or were you saying to yourself, you know, like, oh, okay, this is going to be tough. I can do this, or you don't think about it at all. You just day at a time.
You know, the challenge of it is what I looked forward to and why I did it. Mm-hmm. I knew it would be hard, and that's what made it appealing to me.
Mm-hmm.
If I would have flown another 6 month flight, I thought it felt like it would have just been similar to what I had done the previous time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I looked forward to. So as we were, you know, approaching the space station, there was definitely excitement. I mean, when you survive launch, it's always exciting.
Yes, yes. I'm alive.
Yeah. And but when we docked and I floated in there and I saw how the space station looked pretty similar to when I was there last time.
No place like home.
Yep, exactly.
This podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter. What if hiring could be easier? So even when you're busy, you can still be smart about how you hire. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 top job boards with just one click. Then their smart technology notifies the most qualified candidates to apply. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. Right now, you can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/OP. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OP. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with astronaut Scott Kelly, who last year set the record for the longest time spent in space by any U.S. astronaut. He's writing about that and a lot more in his new book, Endurance, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Discovery. Also out with a children's book, My Journey to the Stars, which makes it very plain. If you've got kids interested in space, life on Earth and its realities, too, we'll talk about that. He's with me in the studio. We're on Facebook Live. If you want to check it out, we are streaming there right now. And you can join us on air. How do you picture the day-in, day-out life on the space station? And how many days would you sign up for out there? Have you dreamed of taking a spacewalk? Have you thought of having your spacesuit torn open by space junk? That fear is out there as well. This was not the first time in space or on the space station for Scott Kelly. Here he was in 2010 on the International Space Station describing how astronauts get their shut-eye at the end of a day.
Sleeping is done on the wall here in a sleeping bag. It's a very comfortable way to sleep once you get used to it. At first, it's can be rather difficult, but once you get the hang of it, it's actually really comfortable, more comfortable than on Earth, for me at least. I sleep much better up here than I do in my own bed at home.
Advantages of weightlessness in space. It's not all hanging around, though. Sleeping on the wall, October 2015, Scott Kelly went on his first ever spacewalk, spent several hours outside the space station performing upgrades, maintenance. Here he is communicating with fellow astronaut Tracy Caldwell Dyson, who was back on the ground at Mission Control in Houston.
Okay, Tracy, I got the MLI bag in front of me. I'm going to throw down the large, small, adjustable. I think on 8605, if you guys think that's a good idea.
We're good with that, Scott.
Yeah, and he's out in space, just tethered. We'll talk about it. And then we have this pretty wild situation where Scott Kelly, of course, is identical twin of Mark Kelly, another astronaut. Here's Craig Kundrat, Deputy Chief Scientist of NASA's Human Research Program, talking about what scientists can learn from the experiments they were conducting with Scott Kelly that year on the International Space Station, and his twin brother, astronaut Mark, who remained on Earth.
We can monitor what kind of changes occur in Mark in an ordinary lifestyle and compare those to the changes that we see in Scott in flight with essentially the same gene set. And so when we see significant differences in Scott that we don't see in Mark, then we're on to, we have a good clue that there may be something to follow up on. It could be the weightlessness, it could be radiation, it could be the isolated, confined nature.
They would both be poked and prodded and test to a fare thee well. Scott Kelly's with me in the studio. Is that still going on? Are they still following up on the physical effects for you and Mark, comparing, contrasting?
Yeah, they'll follow up with them for the rest of our lives, but fortunately only once a year.
Ooh, that's great.
Much better.
How did it happen that you guys both became astronauts? Did they want you exactly for this so they could keep one on the ground and compare, or you were just both bowled your way in?
Potentially NASA made some kind of clerical error by picking both of us. No. You know, we were both test pilots at the time. I actually had a really interesting and unusual path, I think, to becoming an astronaut. My brother's was a little bit more traditional.
Ooh, tell us.
Well, I was a kid when I was younger. My whole education growing up until I was in college, I was this kid that couldn't pay attention and do his homework, very much like I think people that have ADD or ADHD. Yep. I think if I was in school today, I'd be diagnosed that way. So I didn't do particularly well.
Mm-hmm.
I did go to college because it was kind of expected of me, and I wanted to go. But still, when I got there, I still couldn't pay attention, and I was, you know, struggling. And then one day I go into the bookstore and I, you know, to buy gum or something, not a book.
Yeah.
But I saw The Right Stuff on the shelf. I picked it up.
Tom Wolfe's book.
Tom Wolfe.
Fantastic book. I remember being thrilled by that.
Yeah. And it, you know, changed my life. It was a spark that made me aspire to do something that, you know, I didn't really think was possible, but I was going to try my hardest to get there. And that was to become an astronaut like the guys in the book.
But your path in versus Mark's path in, your twin?
Yeah, so my brother went to the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy straight out of college or straight out of high school. He got his act together in the ninth grade versus me. It took me much longer. And then, but we both wound up in the Navy as test pilots, both applied to the space program. And due to, you know, we were prepared, I think, had a good resume both at that point. But I think there is some luck and timing involved. And, you know, I think that's definitely the case with Mark and I. Now, having said that, when it came time for me to be assigned to this flight, it wasn't because I was an identical twin. That was actually a serendipitous thing that we realized later, that there was the potential to get some interesting science, especially science in the genetic area that NASA previously hadn't ventured into.
Did they learn that there's some impact on genetics of time and space?
We've seen there's some interesting results. A lot, many of the results have not been published yet. And the way science, you know, science is a long process. You know, not only do you have to collect the data, but you then analyze it. You write the research papers, you have them published, and at NASA, that generally takes 3 to 5 years before the results are published. But there was one interesting result that I've heard about several months ago, and that is our telomeres. And their telomeres are,
These are the ends of the chromosomes?
Yeah, the ends of the chromosomes, the length of the chromosomes, the length of these, and the quality is an indication of our physical age. So as we age, they get more frayed and shorter.
Yeah.
And the hypothesis was, you know, I was in space, a lot of radiation, microgravity, stressful environment.
Yeah.
Mine would get in the – go in the direction of aging.
And?
It was the exact opposite. Mine got better compared to my brother's on Earth.
Wow. So it's a spa up there.
Probably not.
Is there an explanation for that, or we have to – think about that.
Yeah, I think they're still thinking about it. Perhaps, who knows, maybe it's the clean living of, you know, a lot of exercise and a very controlled diet.
Not many martinis up there.
Correct.
Are there any? Is there alcohol in space?
No martinis.
Whatsoever. We've heard over time about, like, if you traveled out on the speed of light, you might actually get younger.
Correct. So, and I did.
Wait a minute.
So even though we didn't go to
the speed of light.
We did not go to the speed of light, but the faster you go, Einstein's general relativity, That is no longer a theory. Mm-hmm. It's been proven. But the faster you go compared to a reference point that is not going as fast, mm-hmm. time slows down for the faster person. Actually, it was called the twin paradox, believe it or not.
And here you are.
And I'm a twin. And the paradox is that because I've spent 500 days in space, more than my brother has, going 17,500 miles an hour,
mm-hmm.
where I used to be 6 minutes younger than him, I am now 6 minutes and 13 milliseconds younger than him.
That's amazing. How were you chosen to be the astronaut who would spend more time than any other American astronaut in space? Was it a matter of your body, your mind, your psyche, or why you?
There was certain criteria when we were looking for someone to do this job, and you had to have flown a previous long-duration flight. You had to be someone who was capable of being the commander of the space station, mm-hmm. capable of doing a spacewalk. You needed to be available. In other words, if you were currently in space, you weren't really available to yep. start training. If you had recently gotten back or if you were going to soon go. And then there was also a medical requirement. And when you put the filter of all these things on top of the astronaut office, including, you couldn't have had too much radiation previously because mm-hmm. We're considered radiation workers on base yeah. with OSHA standards.
Just because you don't have the filter of the Earth's atmosphere cutting
correct.
Some of that down.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And so when you put that kind of filter on this group
the
of
pool.
People, you get like two people
okay.
at the
and
end.
There you are.
Me and another guy.
People are asking here if you could describe the space station. I mean, take us in there. First of all, how do you dock? Do you steer or they steer from Earth? And then when you describe the layout, what's it like? What's it like in there? What's it like in the Russian quarters? What's it like mm-hmm. in the American quarters? Just paint a picture for us.
So the space station is really large. If you put it on the ground, it would cover a football field.
Whoa.
Not all of that is in usable volume, but the volume is, the size of a large house.
Okay.
But there's also a lot of stuff inside.
Yeah.
The whole structure weighs 1,000,000 pounds. It's kind of connected like, I don't know if Legos.
Tinker Toys,
yeah,
Legos.
Tinker Toys, mm-hmm. yeah, these modules, mm-hmm. what we call them, are little rooms that are connected together. There's a Russian half of the space station and a U.S. half. And the U.S. half also includes the Japanese and European modules, the Canadian robot arm, mm-hmm. all the other international okay. partners. And they are different. The U.S. side is, roomier, generally has more sophisticated science equipment.
Okay.
The Russian side looks, a little bit older and less sophisticated, but still, practical and functional. The Russian Space Agency actually does a lot with the funding they have. They do a pretty good job of using, what they have and
mm-hmm.
in a
efficient
very,
with not a whole lot of dough.
Yeah, very efficient way. The modules look different, the lighting's different, they sound a little bit different.
How do you spend a day up there? Are you just hanging? Are you strapped in a seat? Are you hanging from the wall? Are you walking around? Is there such a thing as walking up there?
You float around. Microgravity, you're floating. When people first get to space, it's funny when you see them. If a rookie, you generally, fly like Superman
mm-hmm.
in the Superman Woo-hoo! Orientation. Yeah.
Yep.
As you get more comfortable, you'll float around more upright, but you'll do it with, translate around, move around with your hands,
okay.
grabbing things.
Mm-hmm.
And as you get really experienced, eventually you start moving around with your feet. So kind
of
like
pushing off of stuff that's around.
Yeah,
you.
We have handrails that we mm-hmm. hook our toes under. But
mm-hmm. So you can see if your hands free to manipulate things
exactly.
and do things.
Exactly. You can do other things with your hands, and when you get better at it, you can move around with your feet.
Does everybody up there have a signature way of moving? I mean, you do the butterfly, or I don't know what.
Well, we've never. I don't know. I was up there for so long that. After a while, I was really good at being able to maneuver just using my, big toes.
Yeah, along the rails.
Yeah, correct.
Wow. Scott Kelly spent 340 days in space, more time than any other American astronaut in history. He's with me in the studio. His new book is Endurance, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Discovery. So what marks the time? Do you sleep on a regular schedule?
Yeah, we operate on Greenwich time.
Okay.
not because it's the, you know, international standard. The Royal Observatory kind of keeps that as a standard of time. It's more due to the fact that we have all these control centers around the world. People work in them. And Greenwich time was the most convenient for mm-hmm. all these control centers, particularly the one in Moscow, because the folks that work in the soup, it's called, the mm-hmm. control center in Russian, get to work on the Moscow metro, the public transportation system.
Okay.
And us on the space station having our day based on, you know, a Greenwich time, which is, you know, 3 hours a few hours
ahead of East Coast
ahead
time.
Of, well, yeah, or and behind or a few hours ahead of the time in Greenwich was convenient for those people to get to work on the subway.
Okay, okay. Work for them. And up on the station, do you have a routine? Like every morning, you know, now I do science. Now I eat breakfast. Now I exercise. What do you
– so I would generally
– play my ukulele. How do you pass the time?
Yeah, so I would generally get up about 45 minutes before I had to do something, and that would be, you know, 6:30 in the morning.
Whatever that means. Does that mean something? Morning? Morning in Houston or morning in Moscow or morning where?
It's morning in morning Greenwich.
Okay.
England.
Okay.
You know, in London.
It's sort of arbitrary, though.
Yeah, it's their morning.
It wasn't related to any appearance of sunshine or opposite.
Yeah, because we're, you know, we get a sunrise and a sunset, you know, one or the other every 45 minutes,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's really based on the, you know, it's just the time standard that you use. But you get up, you have a, you know, breakfast, normal stuff you might do, brush your teeth, wash mm-hmm. your face. You mm-hmm. don't take a shower because mm-hmm. we don't have one.
Mm-hmm.
Use the restroom. Then we have a conference in the morning with the control center. We go and talk to all the control centers mm-hmm. Just to talk about the plan of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get into the work day, and we have this computer that tells us what we do in like, you know, 5 minute, the smallest increment could be 5 minutes of time.
Is that generally maintenance or science or testing, you know, taking blood? I don't know what.
Yeah, generally three different categories. Science, we had 400 different scientific experiments going on while I was on the space station.
Mm-hmm.
So about a third of your time is spent doing science. I would say another third is repairing the hardware that breaks. Stuff does break at mm-hmm. times. And then just kind of general, you know, housekeeping, mm-hmm. general upkeep of the systems that you have to do. As an example, you know, we make water out of our urine, and we actually use the Russian guy's urine to make some extra water. So often, like every few days, you'd have to get urine in tanks from the Russians, hook it into our system.
Wait, they don't need their own?
No, they actually throw theirs away if we didn't use it. They don't have this same.
How do they get water then?
They actually send it up in a resupply craft.
Well, why? That sounds very heavy. And why the difference?
Because it's pretty complicated hardware and you know, a sophisticated system to distill and filter our urine into water. They are working towards having a capability. They don't currently have it on board.
How's it taste? Did it bug you to drink that, or is it so cleaned up? I don't know, reverse osmosis. I don't know what they use.
Yeah, you know, people joke that I, you know, drank my pee for a whole year, right? Yeah. Actually, I drank everyone's pee.
Oh, nice.
It's all mixed together.
Oh, nice. A real cocktail.
But it tastes pretty good.
Is it all right?
Yeah, it tastes, you know, I travel around the country a lot, and it tastes better than some of the water in certain parts of the U.S.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. What method do they use to clean it?
The urine? We have a distillation assembly, so mm-hmm. it's kind of like a still. So
okay.
Using like evaporation, and then there's filtration that goes on, a series of filters to eventually get a clean water sample.
Did the Russian guys think it was funny, or I don't know if it was all guys or not up there, but to send them – to send you their pee, or are you all you're all past that? You're all
yeah. We've
that.
Been doing that for years.
Yeah, no biggie.
Yeah.
Wow. Are you tired when at the end of a day? I mean, you're not. It's not exactly you're walking 5 miles up there, or maybe you are. Do you exercise?
We exercise, and that's the other thing we spend a lot of time doing, about 2.5 hours a day exercising. And if you didn't do that, the microgravity
fall apart.
Bone loss, muscle loss, you know. Well, there's a bunch of
very special machines to let you do that in space.
Yeah, we have some good exercise equipment.
I I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with astronaut Scott Kelly, who last year set the record for the longest time spent in space by any U.S. astronaut, 340 days. He's writing about that and more in his new book, Endurance, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Discovery. He's also out with a new children's book, My Journey to the Stars, both out just yesterday. You can read an excerpt of Endurance at our website, onpointradio.org. You can see Captain Kelly on Facebook Live right now. We're streaming video there. He's with me in the studio. And you can join us. What do you think? Does hearing the details of all that time in space make you more or less drawn to spending yourself time in space? And what about at Mars and beyond? What's our space destiny? Callers for you, Scott Kelly, Jay in Chesapeake, Virginia. Jay, you're on with Scott Kelly.
Greetings. Quick two-part question. Are there windows on the space station? If so, did you personally observe anything that may have been, in your opinion, a UFO or unexplained phenomenon? I'll hang up and listen to your answer on the radio. Thank you.
Jay, we got it.
Yeah, Jay, so yeah, we have some windows on the space station. We actually have a module of windows called the cupola, which is really gives you a incredible downward-looking view of the Earth.
We saw your photographs. Just amazing.
Yeah, so, you know, and to answer your second question, there are times when you'll see something in orbit that you're like, you know, that's really not tracking like I expect it if it was like a satellite or a star as it's moving behind the, in the star field. But then, you know, after a few, 10, 20 seconds, you realize it was just the, how the light behaves through the, the atmosphere on the limb of the Earth. And then you, quickly mm-hmm. realize what you thought was something that looked suspicious really is just a satellite or a star or a planet. So I can understand how people sometimes look at video from the space station and you see something that is hard to explain and you mm-hmm. think it's a UFO, meaning I guess a flying saucer or something.
Yeah.
But really it's not.
Does it feel lonely out there?
It's lonely out in space, as Elton John said. It's not lonely.
Well, you got other guys or maybe sometimes women as well on the space station. You've described the smell of space, and that surprised me. Share it.
Yeah, so whenever we have a volume, whether it's the airlock or if a resupply ship or, a Soyuz that was had just docked and then you had to fill that vacuum with air, and then once you open the hatch, you can actually smell the air. There's a smell to that space that was exposed to vacuum. Now, clearly, space means nothing, right?
Right. There's no air out there, but the air in the space lock was exposed to it, and it's got a smell to the human nose.
Yeah, I think it's the fact that the hardware has been exposed to a vacuum, maybe the sun, and it does always have a very unique smell.
Describe it.
It smells like welding or burnt metal or maybe like sparklers on the 4th of July. I've heard other people describe it more like a sweet smell. It doesn't really smell sweet to me. It smells more like burning metal.
Is that the smell of space or is that the smell of Earth material exposed to the vacuum of space?
Exactly. I think it's the smell of the module, the airlock, the hardware that was just recently at vacuum.
But it's the olfactory experience of being right there. Lori in Orlando, Florida, you're on with Scott Kelly. Thanks for calling, Lori.
Hi, Tom. My question is kind of strange, maybe, but do you ever get time off, the weekend off, like you would on Earth? And if so, what do you do with that time? And I'll hang up and thank you so much for your service.
So, technically speaking, we have the weekends off. Now, when we have the weekends off at home, a lot of the stuff we do, like, cleaning your house or other chores you do on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a similar situation on the space station that we do the cleaning of the space station on the weekends.
Does food really float away? You talked in that tape we played about asparagus that got lost somewhere.
Yeah, you find stuff all over the place.
Yuck. I mean, or maybe not. Does it decompose in that? It would, of course. You've got oxygen there, so it would.
Well, when we clean it, usually stuff that floats away will wind up on some filter, because there's suction.
A little suction going on.
But I did find a drink bag that had a former astronaut classmate of mine's initials on it, and that drink bag had been floating around on the space station for like a year and a half because he had not been there for right. a year and a half.
Gerald writes to us, says, please ask how obvious and important the borders between nations look from orbit. And also, on the space station, I guess, how important are differences in language, custom? Is there other different cultures in addition to different sort of turf areas of the station?
So generally speaking, you don't see political borders from space. I mean, if it's nighttime, you can tell.
Make out where cities are anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And you can see the DMZ. It's very obvious.
You mean in between North and South Korea?
Between North and South Korea. But generally, you don't see political borders from space, which makes the Earth, you know, look like we're all part of this
one happy family,
this human experience all together, and gives you a sense of you know, empathy for the planet, the environment, and the people.
It's a fact. We are all part of this experience together, whatever we draw on the ground.
Yeah, clearly. Yeah.
And what about inside the space station? Are you aware? Do you interact with the Russians? Are there cultural differences that become very clear up there?
Absolutely. There are cultural differences, you know, based on, you know, what country we came from, or maybe even based on, you know, what our profession was prior to becoming
an astronaut. Some are flyers and some are not.
Some are, you know, fighter pilots, and some are people are scientists. But in my experience, having that, you know, not only the international aspect, but the diversity of the group of people that have the privilege of having this profession makes for a stronger team. It makes for a stronger program. People have different opinions, different ways of looking at and solving problems. So, you know, that cultural difference and just diversity in general makes us a better space program.
It's good to hear. You describe a moment in the book, in Endurance, where there was a risk, I guess quite a real risk, at least it appeared for a time, of some space junk colliding with the space station that might have been the end of all of you. What was the risk there? What was the problem? And share the way that the American crew was brought to respond and how the Russians responded.
So in the first of all, the space station gets hit by space junk every day.
Are we talking meteorites, or are we talking wrenches that somebody dropped 10 years ago up there?
We're talking both. Or you know, pieces
satellite.
Of a satellite.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, there's been collisions in space that have created space junk. There's a lot of stuff out there.
Okay.
And there's also stuff that's micrometeoroids that also hit the space station. This stuff is generally small, does not cause significant damage, but there are holes on the handrails on the outside of space.
Really?
It looked like someone shot a bullet at it.
That would go right through a spacesuit, presumably, if it hit you.
Absolutely. Yeah, so it's definitely a risk. But normally, if it's a big piece, I think bigger than like maybe 10 centimeters, the U.S. Air Force can see it.
And they tell you and you change course to avoid it? Or
They do that automatically. Yeah, sometimes even when we're sleeping.
From Earth, they'll adjust your...
They can adjust their altitude.
So you're weaving in and out of significant pieces of space junk.
At times. I think over the course of the year I was there, we probably did maybe 3 debris avoidance maneuvers. But sometimes they either don't see it early enough or the math, the calculations aren't right.
Oh,
and then later... It looks like a risk, but they can't do anything about it because it's too late. And in that case, and this has happened 4 times in the 17-year life of the space station.
And you were up there for a while.
Yeah, I was up there with, at the time, just 3 of us. And we had to do what's called shelter in place. That means we were going to go to the Russian Soyuz. If we did get hit, potentially we could, you know, do an emergency undocking. Now, whether this would actually be possible or not is...
Yeah. I mean, you got in the little capsule, all 3 of you.
Yeah. You know, because in the case we had a Russian satellite coming at us at 17,500 miles an hour in the opposite direction as we were going, which is a 35,000-mile-an-hour collision, which is 20 times faster than a bullet from a rifle, which probably means if we would have gotten hit, we would have never even known it.
But there was a point where you were describing how NASA had you like shutting all the sections, and the Russians were
there was 3 of us on board.
Could be your last day of life, and
But, you know, NASA looks at things a little bit differently at times than our Russian colleagues, you know, based on our experience. We had two fatal accidents with Columbia and Challenger before it. And, you know, those were a failure of not hardware, but failures of leadership management to take action on risks that we knew were there. But we thought that it was so low that we weren't going to do anything about it. So, you know, NASA's philosophy is, you know, if we can do something, even though it might not help
so
much.
You were battening all the hatches. Yeah. And what were the Russians doing?
They were having lunch.
Like as if it, if this is our last lunch, let's have a good one?
Yeah, let's just have some lunch. But, you know, we're going to go to the Russian, the Soyuz just in case. Maybe if we get hit, we can escape. I think the reality of it is if you get in a 35,000-mile-an-hour collision, your brain's probably not going to have the time to process that.
We're talking with Scott Kelly, retired astronaut now, but last year he ended the longest time, consecutive number of days in space that any American astronaut has ever spent. He's out with a new book called Endurance, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Discovery. Take us through a spacewalk. You did one on this trip. What's it like? You suit up, which you don't normally have that big bulky space suit on. I guess that's the only time you wear the big thing, right? Is it the same one you wear when you come back to Earth or different?
Yeah, it's a different suit. The one we go outside, meaning a space walk in, is more like a little spaceship. It's designed
with arms and legs and a head bubble.
Yeah, it's like a suit, but it also has a life support system. It has a communication system. It's much more sophisticated than the one we launch and land in, which is really just to have on in case of an emergency, like a depressurization or a fire. So the spacewalking spacesuit is much more sophisticated. Mm-hmm. The spacewalk itself takes weeks of preparation and study and preparing the tools and the suits. The day of the spacewalk, you get in the suit a few hours prior to actually going outside. My first two spacewalks were almost 8 hours long.
Wow.
So we were in the suits for almost 12 hours. Mm-hmm. They are very they work great, but they do have some challenges in how the joints move. And
they look bulky. As good as they are, they look like that's a lot to wear.
Yeah, and the gloves are really difficult to work in. You don't have good, you know, dexterity. Mm-hmm. You don't have, you know, they're very stiff because the suit's pressurized.
You're tethered all the time, obviously, to the craft.
You're tethered, and I don't know why they call it space walking because it should be called space working because it's a lot of work.
And you're floating. You're not walking anywhere.
Correct. You're crawling around with your fingers on the outside of the space station doing, you know, whatever maintenance tasks you're going to do or something else. And it's I call it type 2 kind of fun.
That
type
is.
Type 1 fun is the roller coaster. It's fun while you're doing it.
Yeah,
the Wii kind of fun. Type 2 is the fun when it's done. You're like, man, that was really hard, but that was awesome. That was the most incredible thing. But it's hard work while you're doing it.
You're aware when you're doing that if some piece of space junk comes along, that spacesuit is not going to protect you.
Yeah, potentially not going to protect you. I think it depends on what hits you and how big it is and how fast it's going relative to you. But absolutely, I mean, there's debris that hits the outside of the space station that if it hit us in the suit would not be a good day.
Sylvester in New Orleans. Thanks for calling, Sylvester. You're on with astronaut Scott Kelly.
Hi, Tom and Mr. Kelly. My question is, what does Captain Kelly think about the relevance of NASA? You hear about private companies that are going out to space and people think that NASA is not relevant anymore. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, NASA has actually teamed up, actually supports companies like SpaceX.
You got grocery deliveries from SpaceX.
Yeah, we get resupply craft from SpaceX and from a company called Orbital ATK. And, you know, that's part of, you know, NASA's program is to work with these companies to bring supplies to the space station and eventually people.
So do we need both, or NASA's irrelevant, as Sylvester's asking?
Well, by doing that, NASA can focus on deeper space exploration, human and robotic. But, you know, the part of NASA I worked in was the human exploration part. Mm-hmm. So having companies like these commercial companies help us with low Earth orbit transportation allows NASA to focus on the more challenging things, the more going to Mars, going maybe back to the moon.
Are we going to go to Mars? I mean, Elon Musk is already talking about sending cargo out there. Are we going to go? Will humans go? You have spent a long time. Can our bodies take it?
I believe we're going to go to Mars. I think we could probably go to Mars pretty soon. There are still some challenges to solve. The radiation issue as we get away from the magnetic field of Earth, radiation is going to be a challenge. But I don't think that's something that will prevent us from going. And I'll steal a phrase from my brother that he often says, and going to Mars is not about the rocket science. It's about the political science,
meaning
we need support from the public, support from our elected officials, and the money to do it.
And having spent 340 days in space, when and if humans set foot on Mars, will they have the strength to do what it takes up there?
Yeah, going to Mars with our current technology would take, you know, I think a little over 200 days to get there. You'd spend a year on the surface, 200 days to get back. I think for that trip, we would be able to operate on the surface of Mars after that length of travel.
So even though it takes a physical toll, you think humans could do it?
Yeah, I think, you know, you'd have to ease into your work when you get there.
Yep.
But yeah, it's absolutely possible.
Nobody speaks with more authority on that than Scott Kelly. He spent longer on consecutive days in space than any other American astronaut in history. His new book on all that is Endurance, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Discovery, and a kid's book out as well, My Journey to the Stars. Scott Kelly, Captain Kelly, thanks for all that, and thank you for being with us today. Really interesting talking with you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Tom.
Scott Kelly. Listeners, thanks for joining us right here on Earth. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.